so interesting that there's a real link between ADHD and addiction.
Yeah.
You're 5 to 10 times more likely to struggle with alcohol or drugs if you have ADHD.
Have you ever been face down in the toilet at 4 a.m, spewing up your guts, thinking to yourself, I can't do this again?
Or maybe you've waited 55 minutes in the rain outside a pub to meet a dealer, just to find out he ain't coming.
Broken bones, empty wallets, and lost friends. With big nights come big regrets.
And hey, we're not here to judge. We've had some absolute howlers on the sesh ourselves, but now we're trying to draw the line. I'm Jamie.
And I'm Tom.
And we're two old friends who, after over 30, that's harrowing, Tom, combined years in the music industry, have decided that change is upon us.
It's been hard, but it's very possible. And that's why we started this podcast, to be your support for a life free from the naughty stuff.
Join us each episode as we interview celebrities, musicians and influencers about cutting down on substances from their lives. Hear about how they did it, their motivations and how they're coping.
We aren't here to preach. No judgment, no rights or wrongs, no censoring. This is just an honest account of people changing their relationship with alcohol.
Welcome to They Think It's All Sober.
They think it's all over. It is now.
Welcome back.
Baby's back.
You've landed like all of about 13 hours ago, and now here you are in my kitchen.
Mate, it's like a baptism of fire. I left my hotel in Sydney at 3 a.m. Sydney time, what feels like yesterday. And then I was traveling, I think, for like 26, 27 hours. And then obviously now, yeah, I'm here. So it's been a whirlwind.
Sitting around a kitchen table at a normal time without any white stuff.
Yeah, I know, mate. Well, you very kindly ordered me a coffee, so thank you so much. Arrived by delivery. You're like the only person I've ever known to order a Deliveroo coffee.
I know. And do you know what? I don't ever do that because it's the epitome of laziness. But I was in a rush this morning because I'm off to Cornwall.
Yes.
First thing in the morning. So just trying to sort the house out and sort cars out. And obviously it's Easter holiday, so Zach is roaming around like a lunatic.
He is. He showed me all of his Easter eggs.
Yeah.
I've tried them all. I haven't even eaten today yet. And the first thing I was forced to eat was a popping candy Easter egg. So I'm feeling quite confused.
So, but yeah, here we are. And how was your trip?
Man, amazing. It's difficult. I always try not to romanticize things because I'm an emotional person, right? And I think every time I've gone to Oz, I'm so fortunate. This is my 7th trip.
Right.
I think I was touring there basically every year up to 2017, 2018. And then obviously COVID happened and I was, you know, haven't been back since. It feels like home to me. Like I love it there so much. And I have so many amazing friends. Without sounding like a fucking hippie, like taking off your shoes and just like being able to walk around barefoot and feel grounded and watch beautiful sunrises. And one day I walked more steps one day than I did when I did the fucking marathon, like 44,000 steps,
wow.
Just like exploring. So I love it. I absolutely love it. And had the best time. The shows are amazing. The vibe's good. Yeah, I feel grateful. It feels like I've been away for like 7 years.
Mate, it feels like you have been gone 7 years.
It was
years.
2 weeks.
I know. And we were conversing at, you know, because you have that window, don't you, in morning and evening.
Yeah.
It's like the opposite to LA where you have the same, but it's just a different
flip. Yeah, yeah.
Where, you know, I'd be waking up in the morning and it'd be your evening.
Yeah.
And we'd catch up and we'd speak about stuff. And then the same thing, like in my evening, you'd be like, morning.
Yeah, I know. And, like, fuck off.
but yeah, mate, Australia, I love it. Like, as you know, like half sort of my mum's side of the family are all out there. And talked about it before, like if there wasn't so much stuff going on here, you know, with family, and once you kind of put your roots in somewhere, that's your home. I feel like it's hard to move, but I would. Melbourne is like my vibe.
I'd be there in a heartbeat. I really would. And obviously I don't have children, so it's something I will seriously consider in the next 5 years if that is something I look at doing.
Sure.
And band work could be there. But no, mate, it was amazing. The shows were great. I had a wobble though, like a pretty big wobble, and I voice noted you about it at the exact time. I had no desire to drink the entire time I was there. Right. And there was amazing zero options. I think I shared that post. Like
Heaps
Normal was great. Clean Brew, I think it was called. Loads and loads and loads. But the last night of the tour, big dance music indoor festival, 3,000 or 4,000 people there. Everyone's really excited. Being a real big success. there were fucking bags flowing. And when I say bags flowing, I mean any dressing room I walked into, there were bags.
Yeah.
And it was rife. And I've been around a lot of people doing coke since I've quit, and I'm totally fine with it. And I had seen it a few times since I was there, and I was fine with it. And I wasn't like tempted at all, but it was the first time I think I'd really been super immersed in an environment where everyone was like free pouring vodka. You know, I was like, said to my client, oh, do you want a drink for stage? He was like, yeah, I'll pour a vodka. And suddenly I found myself like alone in a dressing room pouring like a big measure of vodka. And the thought did cross my mind, like, oh, if I just had a swig of this, like, no one would know.
Yeah.
I didn't want to, but it like, I was like, whoa, okay. Cause my, I've done so many shows since I've gone sober, but I've not really been on my own in that environment where everyone's just fucking on a mad one.
Yeah.
And then bags upon bags upon bags upon bags. The show finished at like 2 and everyone was going to this like private after party, sick club, like one of the, you know, massive, massive DJs was going to do like a secret garage set. And I was like, fuck, I really want to go. But I just thought to myself, like, I wasn't tempted in the sense that I wanted to do it, but I felt like I needed to take myself out of the situation.
Yeah.
And again, maybe wobble's the wrong term, but I definitely like something in me switched for the first time in my sobriety.
Right.
Where I was like, I don't want to say like I could do this and no one will know. It wasn't that, but it was very much like, okay, like I've beaten this thing and I know I'm not going to do it, but I need to take myself out of the scenario so I definitely don't do it.
Yeah.
You know, and I voice noted you and I voice noted a couple of people that I knew would understand and, you know, everyone was really supportive. And the great thing was it was like 3 p.m. here, right? So you guys were all just awake.
Yeah, yeah.
And on a Saturday evening or something. So we're like, bro, you got this, whatever. And I was fine, but I don't know, how did it seem to you when I voice noted you? Because you were like, you must have just got, out of the blue, just got like a 2-minute voice note from me.
Well, I think it was that slight thing, isn't it? Like almost when you hit me, it was almost like, the slight FOMO aspect. You were like, my client is going to this club with all the promoters and it's blah, blah, blah. And like, and I felt for you because I know that like in old days, a lot of business and camaraderie and stuff happens, you know, you don't need to do it. And you're like testament to the fact that you don't need to go and start railing lines at the club at the after party with the promoters to like forge that relationship. But, you know, I felt that like, you almost like, ah, I kind of feel a little bit missing out on it. And I was like, bro, you've done like the right thing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, your client's there, everyone's having fun, and you were there and you watched the show and met everyone you needed to, and nothing good would have come from that other than you being knackered.
Well, yeah, put it this way, one of my team who did fully send it got in, I think, at like 8 a.m. They not only went to that afters, there's a club called Sash in Sydney that's basically open for 72 hours on a weekend that runs through till 9 a.m. on the Monday morning. And yeah, he went there and I didn't hear from him the entire next day. And then he was like, yeah, I just fucking absolutely got cooked. But I think you're right, actually. Now you've said that, that was it. It was the thing of like, what am I missing out on? Not that I want to do this.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think it just goes to show that like, I'm what, 20 months in, 21 months in to this. And like, it gets easier, of course, but you're still going to be in some scenarios where all of a sudden I was like, okay, like I had an issue with coke without a doubt. Yeah. Like I can say that now and I'm fine being around it. But like, literally, I mean, keys were just like Matt. It was Matt Willis scenario where he just said he was in a dressing room one day and there was just keys going around and he just thought, fuck it. And it would have been so easy for me to say, fuck it.
Yeah.
And I'm so grateful for my own brain, for you, for this pod, for like the sober people around me, because that's all that came into my head. Because I really could have just been like, you know, I'm there with like one of the biggest fucking dance promoters out there who's like gassing up my artist, giving me like a 3-year plan. We're like going for it with this guy. It's, you know, it's shows are all selling out. It's like in the best place it's been. I'm like texting people like, fuck, this is crazy. And it's so easy. It could have been like, mate, I'm going to send it.
100%. And it's difficult in that situation where you're surrounded where everyone else is on it, because then you're in that kind of situation where it's so normalized. And there's almost that sense of like, just because it's like a general consensus is reached doesn't mean it's the right decision. It's exactly that. Because like, yeah, in a room where there's like 20 people and like, I don't know, 12 of them are handing a bag around doing keys. So normalized that in your head, it would be very easy if you weren't like, you know, headstrong to be like, oh, well, everyone else is doing it, it's fine. Like, you could so easily have that mentality. And yeah, like you said, I mean, I think you did great by, you know, by just removing yourself.
Well, it was funny because then I still got into bed and it was like 2:30, 2:45. And I was like, this is dumb.
Yeah.
Like, what would have changed? And also one of my other colleagues said to me this morning, actually, because I kind of spoke to him about it. He was like, you're such an energy guy and you thrive off of energy and you give energy. And in the past, you were like the leader of the energy, that I can see why there's almost like this hive mind thing, collective consciousness almost, of like, if everyone's getting fucked up, it's easy just to be part of it.
Yeah.
And no one was like, madness, you know the score in these music things. Everyone's still having the exact same conversations. It's the same energy. Everyone's just a bit like, way.
Yeah.
Gassing each other up, and it's just like vibey. So yeah, other than that, best trip ever. But I'm proud of myself. I almost feel like you've got to put yourself in those scenarios. And I'm really grateful that I can come back here and talk to you about it and talk to our listeners about it. Cause you know, that's the one thing I want in this podcast always, is like fucking warts and all. And I want people to know that like I really struggled and I didn't nearly fuck up, but I easily could have fucked up. And I think, you know, we talk about it. You and David spoke really eloquently about it last week, about that listener that had been 90 days and then had a blip. Like, there are going to be challenges, and it's just how we face them and how we overcome them. And even if I had a massive blip and fucked up one night, I would have come here and spoken to you guys about it and been really honest about it. Does that invalidate what we're doing on the pod? I don't know. It's a lived experience day by day. And, you know, you can only go one day at a time, but I didn't. I fucking went to bed. My anxiety was through the fucking roof, but it was the right decision.
Mate, smashed it.
And I had a couple of difficult work things out there. Like, had to have a couple of difficult conversations, like some of the shows that, you know, you have to deal with issues. And again, I bring myself back on the flip side that if I'd been in party mode, I would have dealt with those in the wrong way. So actually, like, all right, I missed out on the big party night where probably some business could have got done, but people are probably also walking away being like, oh, that guy dealt with that really difficult situation really fucking well. So like, what's the payoff? Like, do the work properly and miss out on one night versus don't do the work properly and feel like shit.
Yeah, mate, exactly. And, you know, coming from the other end of the scale, you know, being, you know, producer, writer, DJ, and having done shows and that, like, you know, having a manager that's like switched on, that's sober, that can be there and, you know, get you drinks, iron out any issues and any difficult situations, and then, you know, hits the hay, is much better preference than you know, the manager that's there, you know, spearheading some sort of like session.
I'm also 35 years old. Yeah. Like, and I've got to remember that, like, my team, I was out there with a 23, 24, 25. The promoter's assistant that was kind of like, you know, spearheading it was 27. Like, I'm older and that is okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you know what I mean? And the main promoter also that was kind of like spearheading the idea of the after party, I spoke to him the next day and he was like, man, I just went to bed. so he did the same thing. Do you know what I mean?
Just rolled everyone up and then ducked out. I mean, that's
I'm grateful for you for being at the end of that fucking voice note though, because it I just was like, Tom.
Oh, mate, as always, glued to my phone. Like, the other addiction that I need to try and trying to iron out. And I'm looking forward to this week away, because where I'm going, a little place called St. Agnes down in Cornwall, was lovely. It's where my mum's from. And
my favourite Metallica song. St. Agnes.
St. Anger.
But
yeah, so I'm looking forward to having limited signal and resources and it's going to be nice.
You've got to give yourself that break sometimes, man. That was the thing I felt whilst being away. Like, I still worked probably more because I was getting up early to catch up with the UK and staying up later to catch up with the UK. But there was like a 4-hour period in the day where my phone was dead.
Yeah.
And that's a dream.
Mate, it is a dream. And you know what? I know the weather's going to be pretty crappy, but for me, it's actually just having a break and headspace to step away from work for a week. And it's Easter and, you know, spending time with Zach. So I'm excited. But this week's guest.
Yes. Well, so this is a double header for us, because not only is it two really exciting guests, we can also reveal the very special secret guest for our live show.
We can.
So we can't give one away without giving the other away.
We can't.
So how do you want to roll with this?
I don't know. I think we're just going to have to go for it.
Okay. So the secret special guest for our live show on the 1st of May, in a full, beautiful, circular moment from our first ever podcast, is
Rory.
I'm buzzing, man. Like, for anyone that's listened to the podcast, her interview is kind of what spearheaded this whole thing.
Yeah.
I think it set the tone so beautifully. And her recovery story is so incredible. And what she's gone on to do is mind-blowing. She sold, 10,000 tickets on her UK tour last week. Like, it's all just absolutely mad. So for her to be able to come on with Millie and with David, who feel like such integral parts of the pod, and sit and talk about, like, all the beautiful things that recovery can bring, I am so excited.
Mate, so buzzing for it. So, and obviously this week, you know, she's come on with her amazing partner Rich, and as ADHD Love, who have bought this incredible platform. And, you know, Rich, who himself doesn't have ADHD but lives with Rory, who does.
Yeah.
And it's just like a beautiful platform that they've got showcasing what it's like, one, to have ADHD, but also to live with someone who has it.
Yeah, and both be in recovery.
And both be in recovery.
And that's a beautiful thing. Like, I think that we've started to have so many more questions, I think, post the Suzanne episode about ADHD and neurodivergency, and obviously Rich is neurotypical. So I think this idea of like recovery, meeting in recovery, falling in love with neurodivergency, being neurotypical. Rich has got his own story, which I'm so excited for you guys to hear, because I think we wanted to make sure that he got his chance to speak.
That's right.
Beautifully and eloquently, and actually like probably one of the most moving stories I think we've had on the pod. It's a shame we didn't get a whole episode with him, because I loved him, like, and I thought he was just incredible. So I'm so excited for this week. And it's funny because I feel like we recorded this ages ago, so I'm doing this intro without really having too much memory of the ep, other than it just being amazing.
Yeah, mate, I'm the same. And you know, we wanted to make sure that, you know, this episode came as well when we could announce Rory for the live show. And yeah, I remember it leaving the sort of interview being like, wow, that was like a special ep. Yeah. And I think it's really, really informative. And I think there's a lot of conversation around ADHD and addiction that we cover in this. So great episode.
Well, what I had no fucking clue about. I knew that I'd started to learn through Millie and through Suzanne and through, you know, some stuff that Rory posted online about the links between ADHD and addiction. But to actually sit down and really dive into it, and also, you know, so many of my friends are getting diagnosed finally, and it feels like people are starting to take ADHD seriously in terms of like where people's brains can go and the links with it, I think it's just absolutely fucking fascinating.
Yeah, I love it. So I think we should do it.
Without further ado. So we've got best-selling authors, sold-out touring, infinite amount of hundreds of thousands of millions of subscribers across TikTok, across Instagram, across Twitter, the most incredible, kind, caring, interesting, beautiful couple that is
ADHD Love.
Mwah!
So, welcome to the studio, Rich and Rox.
Woo! It's a new season 3 thing. Like, we're going for this cheer
moment,
so people can see how excited you are.
So, thank you for joining us on this early doors on a Thursday morning.
Shit weather again.
Yeah.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us. My second time here.
Yes.
I'm so grateful to come back.
So you were our first ever guest on They Think It's All Sober. Back in the misty time of June 2023.
Yeah, on the boat.
On the boat. It's gone so quick. You've grown so much.
The boat's
it's amazing.
Gone. No, boat's not gone.
Boat's still there.
It hasn't sunk.
Trying to fucking sell it.
If anyone wants to buy a boat, we're here.
Honestly, I'm
taking commission.
Sure, do it.
Sure. But yeah, thank you for joining us. And yeah, welcome back into the new studio. And we've had so many messages saying, you should get ADHD Love on. Like, it's been nonstop.
Yeah.
And
I reckon you've been like secretly DMing people, being
going, ask
these guys.
All my accounts.
No. Did they say ADHD Love though, or did they just say the ADHD couple on the internet? Because that's usually how we get.
No, it was actually ADHD Love. Oh, so there you go.
The ADHD couple.
The ADHD couple. Get on.
Yeah. Well, that's my name. Whenever I see anyone in real life, it's like, you're the ADHD wife. I'm like, yep.
Or they just go TikTok.
I love that people start shouting social media platforms at you. Yeah.
Bebo, you're like, what? What year is this?
But no, we thought it'd be great to get you both on. I think there's a lot of discussion to be had around ADHD, addiction, and it'd be great, obviously, from your perspective as well, living with someone with ADHD, the trials and tribulations.
That will drive you to drink. I can't believe you do it sober.
So, I think there's a lot to be discussed here. And, you know, this is a platform where, you know, people have requested it. So here we are.
Yes.
And really, really happy to have you on. So little change to the format, I suppose, today, because we've already delved into the time. You've been in the time machine before.
Yeah,
you know, you were the first one in, James.
Was that
time machine.
Pre-time machine?
No, I think
did
we had
the time machine exist. When
I think
you were on
I
the
don't
show?
Know. If, I don't know if you had the.
I don't think I had the. I hadn't figured out what the time machine sounded like yet. It was a silent time machine.
Well, you're in for a treat. Okay.
Yeah, brace yourselves, guys.
I have no idea what's going on.
Yeah, you're like.
Me neither.
You're like, what's happening? Sure. So I think it's actually just quite useful. Our listeners find it useful to kind of go back, and I suppose especially with around the topic of alcohol and how it played a part in your lives growing up, to get a bit of an understanding of the timeline of it and perhaps the timeline of that to where you guys both met and started this wonderful platform as well. Because we've already done yours, if anyone hasn't listened to Rory's episode, please do. Episode one, season one.
Yeah.
The
pilot.
Yeah, it was.
If it wasn't for yours, who knows where we would be?
And I'm sure we'll touch on elements of your journey throughout this as well, just naturally. But I think it'd be great for our audience to know you, Rich, and what journey you've been off up to this point. So I think we should step into Jamie's time machine.
Step in, the doors are open.
Do it. Wow, I'm excited.
Are we ready?
Boom!
Oh, wow. Yep. And we are back. Come on, rocks.
I thought it was going to be something technical.
Do you know where I got the inspiration for it from? Was those toys that were like,
I love it. It's really good.
Yeah, okay. All right.
Like, get me a fucking order the fucking Addy Lee. I'm out of here.
Get me out.
Anyway, so we're back in your youthful times.
Okay.
What were your kind of first memories of alcohol growing up and how did they play a part in your adolescence?
My family's always had a drink. So I remember probably more specifically dad than mum. His sort of hobby was the pub. And I would be allowed to have a couple of drinks, probably as early as 12, 13 years old. And then it just got, more and more of a habit, I suppose. I was drinking in the pub. That's how sort of me and my dad bonded, actually, was in the pub. And playing football and stuff like that. And, obviously got my first absolutely like annihilated drunk at probably 13 years old at my sister's housewarming. I was going round, just finishing the ends of people's, minesweeping.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, nice.
And I was so ill. Like, I think they found me sitting on my sister's bedroom's floor with my head back on their bed and I just threw up. No. And it had like come back onto me. So they were worried I was going to choke myself to death and stuff like that. And then, wait, there's a good end to this story, actually. So after they made me throw up, they put me on my sister's sofa in my sister's clothes. So, sorry, my sister's like 15 years older than me. So she's an adult at this point. And I wet myself overnight in her clothes on her sofa and then got up and went and played golf.
So, still in dress or
in my head you're just in like changed. This really nice pink flowing dress.
No.
Four left.
Just piss stained dress like on the golf course. But that's probably my first like vivid memory of being like out of it, I guess.
Nice.
And how did I suppose your relationship, because I guess like we always talk about the relationship with drink almost being like the good, the bad and the ugly is the timeline we give for it. And actually, certainly my experiences drinking when I was younger mirrored sort of that, like early teen drinking. I think, again, I must have been sick at a couple of housewarmings and family events.
Choosing
and
like dresses at that time. Yeah.
And I guess growing up for your later teens, was it fairly typical, would you say, drinking habits?
Yeah, I think so. I think they got unhealthy when I moved out, when I was adulting, because you haven't got any sort of parental boundaries at this point. So as soon as I moved out, I was probably started drinking every day, and then it would be one or two, and then three or four, and then by the end of my alcohol journey, which probably spanned over until I was 35, I was probably drinking 4 or 5 pints plus a bottle of wine every night. And I don't know how I was functioning getting to work. But to your point, like there was a lot of fun, like, and it wasn't always bad. If I could discipline myself to go to a pub and have 2 or 3 pints and get that little like buzz and be fine, I wouldn't upset anyone. I wouldn't argue with anyone. I'd sleep fairly well. I just less and less I was able to do that. I didn't have the self-control to be able to do it. So now it's sort of none for me. Yeah, because I can't trust myself.
Yeah, we have that conversation a lot, don't we? And there's almost a jealousy sometimes of people when you see them and you're like, how do you have 2 pints and like stop? Whereas I'm like 10 pints in, called a geezer. I'm sat around someone's kitchen table at 6 a.m. Like, how am I here and you're in bed like watching Grey's Anatomy? Like, this is bullshit.
Yeah.
But I think it's just some of us are programmed.
I completely agree. Right. Like, we often speak about actually how nice it would be if we just had the self-control to go and have, because there's nothing quite like it, right? On a summer's day, having a cold cider or a red wine with a steak. But that's the problem. It can't just be that. I would just carry on going
until... like COVID times, you had to order a meal with every drink. I remember the first time I went out and it was like, you'd be like, what do I have now? And I'd have like seven different starters around the table so I could have seven pints. That's when I was like, there's something probably not healthy about my relationship.
Mate, that's the point where I was like about 3 stone heavier and me and Sam were drinking like 8-9 pints a day after session. And then having to get a substantial meal and cleaning like 3 Scotch eggs each as well. I don't know. I must have been clearing like 5,000 calories a night just on beer and Scotch eggs, let alone the other shit I was eating. So like
diet of champions.
Yeah, I know.
That's
wow.
Great.
Yeah. So that's mad. But what was your I suppose during that time, what were you doing work wise? Was it impacting like your sort of professional like career stuff, or did you manage to kind of get through?
So I was a bank manager for 20 years. I was in quite a senior position. And I think if you'd have asked me when I was still at the bank, I would have said, no, it's not affecting me now. But then looking at what I have achieved since sobriety, I would say it 100% would have impacted it, because, you know, what I'm doing now far outweighs professionally and work ethic, and just the amount of energy is far more than I ever did. I just sort of blagged my way through a career for 20 years, really, I think. So yeah, 100%. And like one of the best things for me about being sober is the worst I'll feel in the morning is like a little bit tired.
Yeah.
But versus remembering what I could used to, like you could barely see, like the room would be spinning even the next day. And it was like, oh, I do not miss the hangovers. That's like the best thing about
me. Yeah. That's great. And what, because you've got 2 kids, is that right?
Yeah.
And at what point did their sort of arrival play in the timeline of your like drinking?
Well, my first child I had when I was 18.
Right.
So that was probably, you know, that was probably, no, it's not the reason for drink. Certainly didn't help. And actually, you know, sorry to be a downer now, but like I can look back quite holistically and sort of understand why I was drinking. I don't think it was just for me anyway, it wasn't just a gradual buildup of bad habits. Mine was because I didn't become sober until I got into a therapy room because I was sexually abused when I was 8 years old. Right. And I just know, looking back, that it was my body's way of shutting off that emotion. And I'm not saying I was thinking about that all the time, but what I had the inability to do was feel anything. So if I had a bad day, I would drink more. And having a child at 18 is well hard. I wouldn't recommend it to anyone. Love them to bits, don't get me wrong, but I was skint. I didn't have any sleep. So like the alcohol, didn't have the tools to be able to speak about how much I was struggling. So I would just drink. And that made everything easier, right? Like no matter how low I was, after a few beers, the problems just weren't there until the next morning, and then they were worse. And it just done that over 20 years, I suppose. And then it just comes to a head and go, right, I've got to do something.
Yeah, sure. Such a compounding thing. Because I think the line you always use, which is really good, is alcohol allows you to borrow tomorrow's happiness.
That's such, yes, really.
And it's like, I always love that one because it's so true, whether that's something from... Oof. Childhood trauma that you've brought forward or being in a difficult situation, I think you see a route, don't you?
Yeah.
That makes it easier, but it all just stacks up. It's just like mental Jenga, essentially.
Oh, such an amazing way to describe it. Yeah, borrowing tomorrow's happiness.
Mr. Holland. Like that.
Yeah, I don't think I made it up. I think I saw it somewhere.
Claim it.
You've read it. You've seen it on TikTok.
It,
it was a meme.
Yeah.
I was going to ask, like, because obviously, like, all of that and then a child at 18 and then still going on to a very successful career. So... you must have been very driven. Something must have been driving you alongside it to want to achieve, or?
I think it was, honestly, I look back and I'm like, I don't know how I did it. I think it started, like my progression professionally started with just a need. Like I didn't have any money. I was having to, had a little book with every penny that was incoming and every penny that was outgoing. I used to have to get a bus to Lidl because I didn't have a driving license. Mum and dad had moved to Spain. So like the budgeting need was so strong, like so quickly, and I just needed to earn money. Otherwise, we wouldn't have survived. Babies are well expensive.
Yeah.
And then once I started getting promoted, I was always just good. Back then, it was very just a sales culture, and I was typical person that I wouldn't want to spend any time with now. So I was, you know, larger than life, first one at the bar, but like with that, this persona of sort of alpha male sleazy salesman, not sleazy, cocky.
I know, yeah.
cocky salesman. And I just did really well back then. And I got promoted to like a really senior flagship manager position by the time I was 24. But people think bank manager is really responsible. Back then you just had to be a good sales manager because that's all anyone cared about.
Yeah. That's interesting. Do you think like I don't come from money. I remember like when you actually first start seeing a little bit of money, there definitely is something that comes with, I definitely found that it was almost a little bit of an ego thing at first, being like, holy shit, I've got money. I can go and spend this and do that. And I certainly was that person that would be like getting the rounds in, you know, buying for everyone, doing that and kind of becoming...
Here's 10 bags of Coke. Help yourself.
On me.
I still hate myself.
Like becoming the man, supposedly. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I guess like it's very admirable that, you know, you had a kid at 18 and then by 24, you're in a position and you're going from, you know, like you say, getting the bus to Lidl to suddenly there. Did you feel like it... You know, it must have felt good actually being successful, but did you feel like it maybe played into drinking or anything else?
Definitely.
Aspect?
It's really interesting. I'd never thought about it until you said it, because I'm really like, is frivolous the right word when you just don't want to spend any money?
No, that's frivolous. I'm frivolous.
Oh, yeah, you're frivolous. What am I? Frugal.
Frugal.
I'm really frugal with money. And I think it comes back to just how important that it was, like, and budgeting and going a little. But I was the opposite at the bar. Like when I was in the pub, I was the first one to the bar. I'd buy drinks for everyone, wouldn't mind. And my need to go to the pub and be the man, I would even take my work colleagues that they would say, no, I can't, I haven't got any money. Don't worry, I'll pay for all of your drinks all night. Not a problem. Just come and keep me company. Oh, like I would say that, but that's how I would feel. Yeah. So yeah, you're completely right. I was absolutely just... It was probably showing off a little bit, like in reality and where I'd come from. It was like, oh, I've earned the right for this, so I'll waste all my money on alcohol.
Yeah, I mean, I think looking at that app and how much money I've saved.
Wow, yeah.
It's like, well, I don't technically know if I've saved it because we talk about the fact
is
that now...
Petrol getting hit.
yeah, petrol getting hit. No, but like, and now the need for me to still drink a pint and most places of zero beer and most places only serving bottles require me to get two. So I'm spending like £11 on getting like a pint's worth and then still buying the rounds for everyone else. But actually in savings of everything else, like the lack of needing to get Ubers home and this and that, it's crazy the amount of money that you do save, isn't it? Like we've talked about it on your episode. Like
I think mine's up to $100,000 now.
Fuck.
And that's 5 years.
I don't see a Rolex on Rich's.
She spent $200,000 on other stuff.
On music videos.
And that's her go-to line as well. Like, sorry to call you out.
It's fine. But like, yeah, I love it.
She loves spending money. Fine, you earn it, you work hard. But it's like, well, I don't spend any money on alcohol. But like, she's definitely spent probably 300% more on other stuff.
No, not like $100,000, because it's alcohol and mine was cocaine, which is ridiculously expensive. It's like, I do think if you've saved that money, you should be able to spend
it. Oh, right, yeah.
I love this.
Music
ADHD
is
Love Charity is launching soon. I feel like Jeremy Kyle.
GoFundMe page,
So
at that point in your timeline, were you aware that your relationship with alcohol was maybe problematic or becoming problematic, or was it just a means to an end?
No, I don't think that I was aware at all. It was actually because I was just in that life. I was playing golf. I would go on lads' golf holidays. I would drink every night. I'd be playing Call of Duty. Like, and I think just before I became sober, I got two divorces under my belt. So 7 years each relationship.
How long have I got left?
We've got three years left.
Come back in 3 years.
Yeah, see you there.
And so I was living in my own sort of flat bachelor pad, I would have referred to it. It was very cringe. And that was just a way of life for me. And I thought, like, genuinely, for a while, I just thought this, I'm just cool. Right? Oh, that naive stage to think I'm really cool for doing this. And it wasn't actually until meeting Rox that I would even, and obviously she was incredibly open about her sobriety, really open about her alcoholism. And, you know, part of the AA way, I suppose, is to carry the message. And I really listened. And all of a sudden, I was really intrigued and something landed really quite quickly. And then it just moved really soon, didn't it? I was in my first meeting probably 3 months after we met.
So we were talking about this earlier. I don't think we knew that. We thought you had met both in sobriety, right? So I think that's a really interesting avenue.
I mean, it happened quick.
Yeah. That's really interesting.
You were like, if I need to date her, I need to get sober.
Yeah. I think you'd, now I think about it, I'm remembering back, I think you mentioned it on your episode, but that'd be really, I'd love to kind of hear about that. So I guess the point of like meeting someone that's obviously in recovery, yourself not being, and then how that plays into
I remember
your own
it
life, right?
Crystal clear. Because obviously I was like a year and a half sober, so I was still in a little bit sober wanker phase. Like, surprise, the best thing ever. Was. Higher power, like absolute wanker. I can't believe you wanted to get with me, but very, very grateful. And he came round to, I was living in a spare room, my cousin's spare room, because even though I was sober, I was still broke in a lot of debt and like rebuilding. And he was the best mate of my cousin. And you came round one afternoon, I don't know, it's like a Wednesday afternoon, like cracked open, it was like a dark ale, it had a ship on it.
Whitstable Bay.
Available from August.
I was like, and we're like drinking it. And then you like said, are you going to have a drink? So I said, oh, no, don't drink. I'm an alcoholic. Start just spilling it out. And he's there like drinking. Mm-hmm. And he's like, so how do you know you're an alcoholic? And I was like, well, I wouldn't really go a day without drinking. It was like my favorite thing. I could never really stop. And the hangovers were getting really, really bad. I was just doing a lot of stupid shit when
just
I was drunk.
Getting the scroll out.
Yeah, like. Getting the scroll. And he was just sort of looking at me like, right. And I could almost see the cogs turning like, fuck, that sounds like me. Was that right?
Yeah, 100%. And like when she was reeling off this list and mentally I was going tick, tick, tick. I was like, shit, something's wrong here. And it made me really reflect on little things. Like when I got home from work, I would be drinking a beer before I'd even taken my shoes off. Like that's how quick. And it was just habit, but that was that's the first thing I had to do. And I was like, well, I wonder what it would feel like to not do that. Oh, that would feel horrible. Right, okay, there's a bit of a problem here.
Yeah, because I think like it's almost like someone, until someone passes you a mirror, you don't really, depending as well on like what your kind of corporate work situation, you probably don't realize half the time. I mean, certainly, you know, being in fucking music and being at festivals and being at football and, you know, same playing golf and doing that, it was never like, never dawned on me in my 20s that I was in like an addictive cycle with alcohol. Whereas actually looking back, I'm like, that's mental. Like that behavior is actually like mental. But until like you actually take a step back and look out and back in, you don't realize. Like, I don't think anyone's to know really. So yeah, it was probably, I guess it's almost that thing where you were there, it's almost like passing the mirror and you were like, oh fuck. Like,
I just thought I was a heavy drinker. And in fact, I used to joke about one of my like famous sayings, I suppose, would be like, I'm a functional alcoholic. Like I'd say it as a joke because I would drink more than everyone else and I would be able to function better than anybody else in the morning. I'd feel internally terrible, but they would say like, how are you not like the walking dead today? And I'd be like, oh, I'm just a functional alcoholic, lol. Like, but it was just true.
Oh my gosh.
I was going to ask like at that point, maybe a bit of a deep question, but with everything that had gone on in your life, were you aware that maybe you were still suppressing certain things, or was this had you started therapy at that point, or did that go in tandem?
No, so my sort of therapy journey, sorry for that phrase, but that started when I was still drinking. So I was on the way to work when I dropped my little girl, so my youngest, in like nursery. I was driving to Woking and all of a sudden I was like freaking out, like I was really anxious, and then I just started crying in the car, and I was like, oh my God. I had a scary boss. So I messaged her, I was like, I need to speak to you. Like, something's wrong. So she came and met me. I burst into tears in front of her. The whole thing was just a mortifying experience and incredibly embarrassing. She was actually brilliant for me. She helped me through work go and see a therapist. Like, I arranged therapy. But, and this is really interesting, well, for me, it's really interesting because I'm sober and I find stuff like this interesting now. But my first therapist really just went in on the science behind why I was feeling anxious and stuff. Didn't really delve into my past or the trauma or the abuse or anything like that. Just started talking about chemicals and dopamine and serotonin and stuff like that. And I love data. I'm a bit of a geek when it's with stuff like that. But that just led to me being medicated. So I took sertraline, I think it was. That didn't agree with me. There's some
you
funny stories.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
just straight into it. Brilliant. No, no build up to that. Yes, I shat myself. No, it was actually all right, fine. I'll tell the story now. I was outside a bank and I was just about to go and complete a disciplinary hearing. So somebody was in trouble. I was the hearing manager and I was outside having a cigarette. And I farted and shat myself in my suit, like full blown suit.
Oh my God.
I'll never forget it.
I thought that was going to take a turn for the worst because I thought you were going to say I was at like a competitor's bank and it was like a dirty protest or something. No.
So I had to sort of hobble into a Costa, sort myself out, threw my boxes into like the sanitary waste bin.
Oh, yeah.
In there. Yeah, anyway, cheers for that, babe.
No problem.
I love the vulnerability. I can't remember what I was actually answering. All right, yeah.
Sertraline.
Yeah, that was where it was. So that really didn't agree with me. And I was still drinking then. And I remember the day that I did that to myself, I was going to Vegas with the lads like the next day for a week. So still really heavily drinking. Carried on taking the medication for a bit. And then that would have been October. And then I met Rox in the February. And so the point that I'm trying to make here is that first therapist that I saw didn't help me. Mm-hmm. The second therapist, my current therapist, has changed my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like I would never do it. So I'm 4 years sober this year. But I even said to Rox, like, I wonder now I've had therapy and I can be emotional and I can talk about this stuff. I wonder if I could have a sensible relationship with alcohol. Like, I'd never try it because the risk is too great, but it is something that I do wonder.
We talk about this a lot because I had a similar, I didn't have the bad first therapist experience, but my therapist that changed my life, I still drank. So that 6 months of going and seeing her religiously and unboxing all my childhood trauma, I felt, as a human, I didn't hate myself as much and I didn't have all, but my relationship with alcohol and drugs didn't change.
Okay.
And I think personally, now I've been sober 2 years, I think it's more my relationship with alcohol that I feel more comfortable. Like, as in, like, the therapy's made me a better human and comfortable human, but I talk about this a lot because that perspective I always think about. And I don't know whether it was me drinking to run away from something, but then I feel like I did the therapy during the drinking, so I can't figure out where I sit on the spectrum of it.
Yeah.
I'd love to, it's so, I said to you yesterday, I had this urge the day that the sun was out and I was like, oh fuck, I didn't want two beers to get fucked up. No. I was just like, I wonder if I could just have two beers.
We hypothesize it about quite a lot. And then I always start doing like, it's like doing the reverse equation. And I keep going back and I'm like, actually, what I really enjoyed the most from drinking was the social. And I still get to go to the pub. I still get to go to gigs. I still get to go and play golf. I still get to go to the football. And I still have that now connection with a Lucky Saint or a beer. Mm. I used to drink to get fucked up. That was my thing. And I'm like, if I have one drink, I definitely could now. I'm 100%. I think I could go and have one or two beers and cap it. But I feel like I wouldn't really enjoy it. I'd find it probably more torturous, the fact that I wouldn't be able to drink more than not. So it's like, but I get it. Like, you romanticize about it, don't you? Because there was a point in their lives for everyone who was drunk, for most people, 95% of people, there were some good times.
Yeah, definitely.
So,
and that's really real. I'm the opposite to you, though, I think. Like, I, so the same in that the best part about drinking was the social element, yeah. like whether that be in a pub, whether that be watching the football, playing golf with the lads, like that was actually fun. The difference with me, I think, is that since being sober, I can't think of anything worse. Like being in a crowd of people or being around, like pissed people do my head in. Yeah. And that's not being mean. Like I would have been that dickhead as well. But like I just...
Mate, like get your fucking hands off me. Like,
I had that on New Year's Eve. This is like just gone. Oh, classic. It was tough.
Yeah. I don't want to sound like a snob, but they are, they repeat that. Oh, mate, I can't handle it anymore. So I'm a bit of a hermit now. I don't really go out. I went to a gig the other day and I was, the happiest I was is when the train was pulling into our local train station. She was like, you seem really
great,
happy.
Though, FYI, guys, I was there too.
It was a great gig. It was loud.
No. But and also like one thing I think we're really vocal on, and I'd love, you know, men in therapy, because it can seem like such a scary thing, right? And I have a lot of friends that I would never encourage someone to go, but I'll be like, oh, maybe you should go and have a chat. And sometimes I'll do the first talk and be like, didn't help, was shit, not going again. But I would really encourage people like you did, which I think is so admirable, is to like keep trying and going and finding that person. Because I do think there is the right person for everyone. And I think it can make such a difference.
Definitely. And I think, you know, even not looking at it through a selfish lens, like my kids are going to have a better life now than had I not gone to therapy. I mean, the eldest one is it's still adapting to the change of my sobriety, to be honest, because they obviously had alcohol dad for the first 15, 16 years of their life. And they became, you know, like my dad and me, like they became a bit of a drinking buddy of mine, not like going out and getting smashed, but having them around and having a few beers, playing COD or whatever. But it doesn't take long to change, actually. It really doesn't. I mean, I did it for 35 years and then started changing my approach and outlook, and it's having an impact with them as well, isn't it?
It is. And it's so interesting when you do your time machine, do the noise going.
That was not the time.
Sorry, it's not good.
That was a poor imitation.
It was very, very poor. But when I think, when you say that, and very often we're looking at our parents, but obviously being a step-parent and you being a dad, I think of Seer and their time machine and how growing up they would have seen their granddad and you drinking. So they learned that, so they became a drinker. They're big into drinking because, of course, we pass it down without knowing. Mm. And you then going sober, it causes difficulties because they're 20, so they live with us at the moment. We can't ban them from drinking, and I'd never want to do that. But we also really want to role model something different, that you can have a really happy life. You don't have to turn to alcohol when you're feeling shit or feeling down. They don't quite agree with that yet, do they?
No.
But it's, I think your decision to get sober will 100% change their futures and their lives and their time machine.
That's
the best thing.
That's massive, isn't it? Because I do think that like the whole role model thing is the most powerful thing you can do as like a parent. And I think even if it isn't apparent at the time, I think it's like planted seeds at the right point for sure. You know, and that's, I always say it, like for me, like I stopped drinking when Zach was three and a half, and he's going to be six in April. And I'm like, that's the thing that makes me most happy about my sobriety, is that he won't actually remember me being like hungover or like, you know, and he knows now if I go out and someone's like, do you want a beer? And he's like, my daddy drinks 0% beers. And they're like, all right.
My daddy's better than yours. Yes.
They're like, all right, you little prick. Like, show off. But no, like, so it's, but it's just like, you know, and I agree. I think like I'm sure that your kids will be looking and be proud of the decisions that you've made.
I think it's more than just the sobriety as well. I think there'll be loads of like little micro behaviors and stuff like that, just that is a byproduct of being sober, that will impact them for the future. The easiest way I can look at it is if I look back, like I wish that I could live in a household where it was just like really emotionally vulnerable and, you know, add on what's a healthy relationship with alcohol, what isn't. And like, this is all just stuff that will naturally be talked about and encouraged in our house. So it's that you don't even, I don't think, need to overtly do anything differently, just living that life and being more emotionally in tune, like is probably enough to naturally rub off on people.
Yeah. They must have thought it's wild that their dad suddenly become like a huge social media presence and, you know, become the ADHD couple.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I'm sure Sia thinks it's the most cringe thing ever.
Well, I think they would have done it first, but now, I mean, they've literally got professional Nepo baby in their bio. So, like, they will...
Oh, because they're making content now. So I think now they're like, oh, maybe it is cool that they're this cringe.
So, yeah, I'm in a lot of their videos, aren't I?
Oh, it's so funny. But also Lily, who's 10, she doesn't go on social media, but at school she's like, somebody saw you on YouTube Shorts. And it's like, oh, that must be so
weird. I think that's what it goes from, doesn't it? I think it goes from maybe at first being like, oh, that's cringy and icky, to, oh, actually, that could benefit me. Because I've had the same with my, like, stepkids, because Sarah's got... Leah's just turned 18, Joshua's 15. So I've been pretty much in their lives now, like 9 years.
Wow.
And, you know, I think at first they must be like, oh, it must be really cool that you're like stepdads in music. And they're like, I don't care. And then now they're like getting festival tickets and like going to Boardmasters.
Do you want to come
like,
to Anne-Marie?
Yeah. And they're like, can you get guests? And I'm like, yep, I can.
But... just get it there where people that like are outside of the sphere, like I never get hit up and they're like, oh, mate, just seen Adele's on tour, Taylor Swift's on tour. Can you get me tickets? I'm like... No.
Like, I don't manage Adele.
Who do you think I am? If I did, I would not be here. I'd be just constantly circling in a helicopter.
Following Taylor Swift's jet around. So,
So you guys meet. You go on your sobriety journey.
Yeah.
How were those first kind of few months as a couple? Because we've met one couple that went sober together, and this is the first time we've kind of spoken to people where someone's been deep in it and someone's starting.
So I was 18 months. So that was alcohol, drugs and sex and relationships. So I was doing multiple programs, right. Every meeting available. And I benched myself from dating as well because just I'd had 10 in a row, all gone wrong, toxic. Often I was the toxic element. Just lots of cheating, lots of like fantasizing, very problematic. And I started to see that as an addiction as well.
Right.
I've sort of since come to realise through therapy that that was more related to kind of relational trauma and attachment trauma.
And ADHD.
Yes. So I was just like very, very dry in all senses of the word. Sorry.
Wow.
Couldn't not make the pun.
Help yourself.
I could not make the pun. But so then we met, but I was like very much in like no dating, no sex, no drinking. And I remember sort of meeting him just being like, oh no, this like slightly emotionally unavailable, quite cool, drinking. Like he was just my type and the exact type I was trying to avoid.
So what you're saying is he was a walking red flag.
He was a walking red flag.
And you loved it.
I loved it. And I was like talking in therapy about, oh, it's so confusing and what am I going to do? But within, it was so different because within a couple of weeks, I shared my story. You poured all your booze down the sink.
I did, yeah.
Sent me a video.
Mate, it was devastating. I had like just bought... like bottles of like Grey Goose vodka and stuff from the airport, and it was all just going, it stank in my kitchen.
And knowing now how frugal you are.
Yeah, I know.
That must have hurt.
£1, £2.
That must have hurt. But you really committed to it. And I think it was just so interesting because even though I was a year and a half sober, I was still so messed up with people. So as we started to like get attracted to each other, it's by no means like I was sober and I was like the perfect one. I was totally fucked up. I couldn't even look you in the eyes, could I?
No, you had to sit around the corner.
I'd have to sit around the corner when we were first talking to each other because my anxiety was so strong. I couldn't look at him because that's how like strong all my issues had been. Like I couldn't talk to somebody that I was attracted to sober. But you were just so lovely and kind. That's what I remember, just like, so lovely and kind and never, you're like, don't worry, you can sit around the corner, I'll chat to you. So never made me feel like weird.
Just really comfortable.
Just so comfortable. And then...
oh my God, the phone calls. It was that was crazy.
Oh my God.
That was actually addict behaviour, I reckon. Like,
from both of you.
Teenage behaviour. We were like on the phone for like 5 hours
every
a night.
Every night. Like, it was a joke. Like, what were we talking about?
No, it was that. It was like that cringe. It's funny though, a lot of friends that I know that have maybe found love a bit later in life, so often they're like, oh, we'll just be on the phone for hours. It seems to be a bit of a signpost. Because like, something healthy.
Well, I think, you know, I really don't want to say these words because it sounds cringe, but we did probably fall in love over the phone rather than face to face. I know that, I know how horrendous that sounds.
We did.
But I think we'd both, but you know, I'm two divorces in, you're like a new relationship every 5 minutes. We like, we were really conscious because we were both sober. We were really conscious that we didn't want to mess it up.
Yeah.
So yeah.
That's really interesting. I found that with new relationship in sobriety and both in sobriety, and when you meet someone that makes you feel really safe when you haven't felt safe before, that's the thing that you're like desperately trying to hold on to. Ooh. And I think when you're getting to know each other, it is so raw and real. And when you're exploring feelings you've never explored before, yeah, it's like, holy shit. And sometimes you find yourself like, do I deserve this? Is this real? Are they going to mess me up? No, it's like, is it me? Is it you? Like, you're going for all these things that maybe in the past I naturally would have just sabotaged.
100%.
You're having to fall in love in this really pure and beautiful, raw
safety
way,
is
right?
The word, isn't it? It's as a kid, you grow up and you want connection or chemistry or passion or fun, whatever. And actually, as you get older, it's safety. Mm.
Well,
it's safety.
Let's not forget, though, like, yeah, it was really strong. It was really great and felt really safe until I didn't. So
it was then.
So I was sober and this is between therapists. And I would say this to anyone, like being sober, you can't obviously escape your emotions. Mm. So like when we were together, I knew something like weird and wonderful was happening, but that anxiety built up, like to your point, well, this is too good to be true. It's going to all end. And I was so anxious. Like one day I remember just being like just redundant in bed. I phoned in sick for the first time in like 20 years. Couldn't get out of bed. Just absolutely convinced it was all going to go wrong. And I couldn't obviously have a drink to like feel calmer and better about it all. And that's when I started seeing my now therapist, who really helped me process some of that, because that was... it was actually in being with Rocks that some really strong emotions came up for the first time, that I didn't have alcohol as a bit of a safety blanket. And that
for you, though. I think if you are sober and you're in a safe relationship, that's when all your shit and your triggers and your traumas is going to come out. And it still does. Years later, I had a meltdown last night about something, didn't I?
You were actually drooling.
I was drooling onto these juggers. I was drooling. And it was something silly. I thought he was mad at me. He said he wasn't. I'm like, I think you're lying. Total freak out to do with some stuff I went through when I was younger. So it's always there, like this relationship that when the safety's there, things will always come up. But it's you learn to trust your way through it. You learn to trust the other person. You learn to always choose to stay and to communicate. It's kind of cool, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
It's kind of cool.
Kind of cool.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool. So you guys meet, you go sober, therapy's working, second therapist is working.
Yeah.
What point was the, I guess coming onto like the ADHD side of things, at what point were you like, did it kind of come up that you were ADHD? When did you get your diagnosis?
So it was when I was 36, so a couple of years ago.
3.5.
Gonna be 40 this year.
Go on though, 40s.
40's great.
Just a little side note. Anyone I know that's 40, people used to say like 30's a new 20, rah, rah, rah. I think the way the world is now, anyone I know that's 40 is like, this is fucking it.
Yeah,
I'm quite excited.
I can totally see that. Yeah. It's just, I think I'd be more happy if I wasn't in music.
But think of it.
Because in music,
achieved,
it's like,
man,
this new artist, they're 40.
No, you're smashing.
14?
Yeah. You are smashing.
But it's
it.
Fine. It's fine. Be the change you want to see in the world. That's what I believe. So I'd been in therapy for a while and I had never thought about ADHD at all. And I sort of describe it as like I had to clear out so much other stuff. So I'd actually been diagnosed first with CPTSD, which is complex trauma. Mm. My mum had died when I was younger and also grew up in just a very dysfunctional home. Lots of affairs, lots of lying. And very often if you've grown up in a dysfunctional home and it's been traumatic, you end up with CPTSD. And the symptoms of that is like hypervigilance, so constantly being on edge, lots of paranoia, thinking people were trying to hurt me or kill me, being really jumpy like this all the time. You're basically like trapped in fight or flight mode. Right. And that led to a sort of mental breakdown really in 2020, which is when I then found the therapist that went on to change both our lives. So my first jaunt in therapy was like working through those symptoms, because they were the ones that were sort of ruining everything. Probably after a good year of working through all of that, I was actually feeling a lot better. I was like calm in my body and kind of, yeah, could just really understand myself a lot more. And then that's when I started noticing like, okay, so I'm feeling better. I'm not having these like paranoid attacks anymore, but I'm losing my wallet like six times a week and I keep getting on the train the wrong way. And that doesn't feel normal.
Sure.
So it's like I had to clear through so many weeds for then these glaring ADHD symptoms to show themselves. And then I look back on life, I'm like, oh my God, it's been there the whole time.
Yeah.
Because I was such a messy fucker as a kid and as a teenager, like couldn't get on top of it.
And as an adult.
And as an adult.
Disclaimer.
Disclaimer. Yeah, but now I can kind of like understand and give grace, whereas then it was like, I'm just like a messy fucker. Okay, cool. I must be really lazy and useless. So you sort of adopt this kind of personality of just being like a fuck up, because it's the only way to kind of get through. And drinking. So like, I live in a pigsty, but yes, because I love drinking. It was, you kind of had to be okay with, yeah, like living in shit and fucking up your life and being in debt. And just I look back and think, bloody hell, I could have really done with a bit of support as a kid. And like adolescence, but obviously people didn't really know then. So yeah, then went on the whole ADHD journey, got obsessed by the idea, was like reading all the books, listening to the podcasts, watching all the TikToks, was like, this is 100% me. Get diagnosed. And then that was, I'd say that was like, obviously both of us in therapy was like the first life-changing thing, but that diagnosis probably saved the relationship, like again.
Yeah. Definitely, because, you know, even simple things, it's really easy and it's not even unexpected that you would be with an ADHD partner and just think they were really like rude and disrespectful and didn't consider you, because, you know, with lateness and, I don't know, just being messy after I'd just cleaned up and stuff. They're all little things, but like they would definitely have built up into me like losing my mind. And it was that really, yeah, sort of saved us and changed our language, and both learned obviously a huge amount and then created this platform, which went crazy. So
it's wild following that you guys have built up in such, like, I guess a relatively short space of time in the grand scheme of platforms.
2 years, I think.
Wow, is it 2 years?
Yeah, it's 2 years.
Wow.
Yes.
That is very quick for how amazingly big it's gone.
But I guess that's also one of the kind of gifts of sobriety, is that you have so much more time to like give back and do something. It's literally like this, right? I love it when people get sober and then they choose to build something, and it's almost like it has a magic to it. Like it just goes really well. Like it's kind of like blessed.
Yeah. And I think there's something with sobriety. We talk about this platform a lot as well, because I think if we were just like two mates chatting about football on a podcast, like, cool. But like the sobriety thing for us, and I hate the word giving back because it sounds really cringe, but like what you guys are doing is like, it's educational, it's helping people, and it's a topic that is still wildly misunderstood by the mainstream. And I think it's so amazing that you're giving people an ability to be like, oh, I recognize that trait. And maybe it'll just start someone's journey that may transform their life. And that's a really powerful thing.
Yeah. It's also so interesting that there's a real link between ADHD and addiction.
Yeah.
You're 5 to 10 times more likely to struggle with alcohol or drugs if you have ADHD. And that's just like, it makes sense. It makes sense.
It's no coincidence, is it?
No coincidence. The busyness of the brain, the hyperactivity, 3 drinks, you're present and you feel great. So I think I was like medicating undiagnosed ADHD with alcohol for a very long time, and cocaine, because cocaine is like a stimulant. That's the medication they give you. So I felt great.
Yeah, I was going to ask about cocaine, because like 3 or 4 of my friends that are undiagnosed ADHD, the moment that they really realized that they should go and get a diagnosis was we would be like sat around a kitchen table doing coke. And I'd be like, fuck, my thoughts are going mental. I'm so stressed. They'd be like, oh, I feel so calm right now. And I'm like, that doesn't add up. And it's not until they were then figuring it out, they were like, ah. And I actually saw something the other day that was talking about it, and that it's a very different reaction.
Yeah.
Right?
100% the stimulant to someone without ADHD, makes them almost hyperactive. But if you have a hyperactive mind, it calms you down. It's laser focus. Like, I remember waking up living in this shithole of a flat in London, in a basement flat, and like there was a bit of coke left from the night before, I do not know how, but like doing a line of cocaine in the morning and then cleaning my flat for the first time in a year.
Wow.
It's so insane. But like, no, I had no idea what was going on at that time.
Sorry.
No, I was going to say, so I guess it kind of makes sense now when you're looking back and being sober and having an ADHD diagnosis, because like, we kind of, just the kind of little bit of research we've done, I guess some of the symptoms of like the ADHD, and correct me if I'm wrong about any of this, but like sort of lower dopamine count, I think is one of the symptoms, right?
Yeah.
Poorer impulse control.
Yep.
Making moderation more difficult.
Yep.
and I guess like as a consequence of things like being forgetful, being messy, questioning your kind of like core beliefs about yourself, resulting in lower self-esteem. So that's like the ADHD thing sitting there. Then you've got alcohol here, which scientifically we know, we discussed before, like the more you drink, the more it disengages your prefrontal cortex, your decision-making part of your brain. So surely those two things combined is just like a recipe for absolute fucking mayhem, right?
Catalina wine mixer, baby. Yeah.
The way you've described it is so perfect. The lower dopamine, the impulsivity, and then this forgetfulness and losing things. I mean, I lose things all the time now. But
not really. I would say not
as much, yeah, maybe as what I used to. But when you add being drunk on top of that, like it's just that I lost 2 passports.
Mm.
I lost a letter my mum gave me before she died. Imagine that. Just being drunk, being a fuckhead, also ADHD. And the low self-esteem thing is so, so key. We've just finished writing our second book, called Small Talk, and it's exactly about that. It's that the worst symptom of ADHD isn't the losing things or the problems with time or the organization. It's the negative core beliefs that you believe about yourself, which is I'm lazy, I'm useless, I'm a failure, I quit everything. And when you believe that so deeply, like you cannot be happy. You cannot be happy in life because you hate yourself 24/7. So actually the best thing I've ever done is work on the core beliefs. Like I'm still a messy fucker, but I don't hate myself for it.
And yeah.
That's where the gold is.
And I suppose in the dynamic of a relationship, like having the diagnosis obviously requires you to understand about ADHD and then I guess be more compassionate towards the things that are, I guess, Laroque struggles with, right?
Definitely. So, well, I suppose the simplest way to put it is like it's no longer me versus rocks when it comes to being tidy or organized or whatever. It's like both of us, because we both struggle with it, right? Like the symptoms of ADHD don't just affect rocks. It's really important to think the partner and the loved ones, it has an impact on it as well. And when you understand it, you can sort of work together, because, you know, one simple thing is if I'm like eye rolling or putting pressure on rocks, if she's stressed out, they will be like the ADHD symptoms will be worse. So like it's the calm acceptance, being chill, that actually ultimately makes your symptoms a little bit better, isn't it?
That I love that analogy, because in my head I'm picturing almost this like third person in your relationship, which is the ADHD.
And you both have to just
deal with that other person, knowing that both of you have got this relationship and there's this 100% person that's like
the mediator
trying to cause chaos, and you're like, fuck you.
100% there, it's like me and you versus the ADHD blob that's out here just like messing everything up. And actually like being loved and accepted for like who I am, that's healed more than like any amount of therapy or even sobriety. It's like being loved for who you are at your core rather than who you always thought that you like had to be. It's like at home, like I'm meeting myself for the first time years into our relationship, because more and more layers start to come out and I'm just like, oh, I'm really silly. And I like dance around and I do like funny jokes, like absolute nerd, absolute loser, but in the best way. Like I never knew, because like I was always trying to be so cool or somebody else or be.
We said on the bus, and this isn't an insult, so like she won't mind me saying, like the internet, certainly the Rory followers think she's so cool. Like, and we were saying on the bus, like that's just good branding. If only they knew
That's blue hair dye and tattoos, and people are like, oh yeah, you're really cool. I'm like, I am the biggest loser you could ever meet. But in a
not
way,
a loser. No, that's not
a loser, no. But like, I mean that in a kind way.
A nerd,
but like,
yeah. A lovable dork.
Yeah, lovely dork. But that, to me, like, that is cool. It's someone that can be themselves. And I've always looked to other people at like, oh, they're so cool. They're so much cooler than me. And like hated it. And actually it's like, nah, being cool is just like being yourself.
Being yourself.
I fully agree. Like, I think a lot of my drinking days were all about being a version of me I thought I had to be.
Yeah.
And it's only in sobriety where I'm like, I'm the exact same. Like, I love documentaries about ancient Egypt. I love aliens. Yeah. Like, I love it. Like, I'll talk. But do you know what? Before you just suppress all those actual the things you actually enjoyed to be a version that you're like, oh, this is
you think people
cool.
might entertain more.
That cool guy's a loser.
Like, yeah. I'll be with you. Yeah.
I think, though, that that's probably why, or one of the reasons that ADHD love has grown so much, because it's like, we're not trying to be cool.
Yeah.
We're just trying to be real.
The first video we posted was about me forgetting to put a tampon in. Like, that's how...
No makeup in bed.
And honestly, I think I was still trapped a little bit in, like, wanting to be cool and how are people going to perceive me. We'd done this video sort of as a joke, on a whim, no idea. Like, didn't plan it, didn't know what was going to happen. And it was a real, like, wake-up call in life. Like, people don't want this reinforced idea of what is cool, like the old school influencer. People just want messy, ugly, real life. And that's, funny enough, that's actually really like set me free, because when that kind of shit goes viral, you're like, right, people know that I forget to put my tampons in. I can't be bothered about what I look like or what people perceive me. Like, the worst shit is out there on the internet.
Yeah, that's it.
It's great.
We've got, like, I mean, lots of our guests we had Sarah Turner on the Unmumsy Mum, and it's like, again, giving a real account of like parenthood, not the kind of glossy front cover that a lot of people make out to be, because parenting's fucking hard. Like, parenting while drinking is like ridiculously hard. And certainly, like, she talks about the amazing benefits that sobriety has kind of brought her, and like raising, so I think she's got three boys, hasn't
three
she?
Boys wow. under 10, I think.
Yeah, all close together. So, I mean, it's just being yourself and being real is the most liberating thing, certainly, that I've found, and just being at ease with who I am and all the shit that I like and don't like. So, one last thing to touch on. I mean, I guess, like, you talked about the ADHD thing with regards to addiction. I think, like, what's really interesting is, again, we did a little bit of like fact finding, and I think it says something like, I think it's about 4% of adults in the UK have got an official ADHD diagnosis. Yet it seems that 25% of people that are currently in like recovery for substance abuse at the moment have ADHD, which is such like a significantly larger proportion.
Wow. That's bang on nearly your 5x metric, isn't it?
Yeah. I think it's probably just like, I guess if anything else, almost like perhaps people that think they might have undiagnosed ADHD or have it as almost like a warning sign for if you're drinking too much, it could be a cocktail for disaster, really.
100%. I think, as you said earlier, mixing undiagnosed ADHD and alcohol, it is just absolute chaos. I've done it for about 20 years. And the two things together, they become much more dangerous. Mm. You know, even the impulsivity with drink and drugs, but also with spending money. So I got in so much debt. There's also a statistic, I can't remember the exact number, so I don't want to get it wrong, but the ADHD people are more likely to have an attempt on their life, suicide attempt. And it's really interesting because ADHD is seen as like, oh, a bit forgetful, a bit late, a bit messy. It's like, oh, well, why are they killing themselves at a higher rate then? Because that doesn't sound serious. But when you play it out, or a bit messy, what happens if you've lived in shit for a year, too ashamed to have anyone come and see your house? What if you've overspent so much on it might be drink and drugs, it might be shopping, 40 grand in debt with bailiffs at the door, that was me, then you can suddenly understand where it gets really serious.
Yeah.
So it's definitely something that we need to talk about.
That point is obviously so powerful, but it just highlights some of the ignorance. Most people on the internet are lovely, or on our channel they are anyway, But some of the ignorance that everyone's got a bit of ADHD, or like you're losing things, everyone loses things. And it's like, yeah. No, you don't understand. It's not, of course, everyone will lose something, but it's this is happening every day to a point that this person is struggling to like function. And that's that's why it's so hard to raise awareness for stuff like ADHD, because all of the symptoms, everybody would have gone through it once. So they hear it and they're like, oh, you're just talking shit. It's not real. Like, yeah. Everyone goes through that. Everyone loses things. Everyone forgets. Everyone's late sometimes. Mm. But it's
chronic, though. I think whenever we try and explain it, it's happening every day. Yeah. So you're losing something every day. Mm. You're forgetting something every day. You're struggling with time every day. You're struggling with work every day. That's how you know it.
I think that's so important, because I think I agree. People kind of use ADHD as a bit of an adjective, and the same with PTSD. And it's not till I've met people more recently that have PTSD that I've realized that using that word, just because you're shocked about something, or like, you shouldn't just be like, oh, that's giving me PTSD. Like, that's a very serious thing.
Yeah.
And I think ADHD is a similar thing. Like you say, someone might display some characteristics, but probably most humans do. And it's not until you research and understand just how intense they can be, that is, you shouldn't just be describing something as something. It's like if someone's like, oh, like you were saying, function alcoholic. Like, to you, you're like, haha, but you were. But some people will just be like, and it's funny, because I probably use that vocabulary in the past, and it's not till you start to understand it that you realise that maybe you should address it.
It's what you just, it's one of my pet peeves. And this is sort of culture in general, I think, now. Mm. People will overuse really serious terms like trauma, gaslighting, all of that sort of stuff, like, or even triggered, like, I'm triggered by that. No, you're just a bit pissed off. Yeah. Like, well, this is what a trigger is. Like, it's just, and it, unfortunately, it dumbs down people that have got real challenges, because there's a lack of education, because it's just so everywhere.
I think that's what it is, isn't it? It's a lack of education. I think that kind of, you know, another classic response we see is like, oh, everyone's got ADHD now. And it's like, well, actually, luckily, we're getting better at diagnosing it, and more people are going to go and try and get diagnosed and get help and actually make sense of their lives a bit more, which is a great thing and it's a positive thing. So
you can't marry that. That's the thing, isn't it? We're in a culture now where everything's so quick and so consumable and swipe, 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 move, move, move. We're naturally all living in that way. So that doesn't make us all more ADHD. It just means that we're consuming things differently.
Yeah.
The 975 did something so fucking funny at their show. Matty was talking and he went, oh, I forget that you're all Gen Z or younger, look at the screen. And they just put a video of him talking like down the mic, and then they had a video of COD next to it on the screens at the O2, and he was like, now you'll listen to me. I was like, fucking
the attention,
I was
like, it's so fully true. Got,
but yeah, I think you're so right. Like, education is so paramount to helping people understand. I guess it would be great, like, with obviously you were sober when you got your diagnosis, but for any of our listeners that are thinking they might be displaying symptoms of ADHD and they might be, you know, feeling like they're in addictive tendencies or they're going that way, firstly, for someone, you know, that's been diagnosed, and for someone that's living with someone, what would you say are kind of the main things people should be aware of, or how they could help their partner?
So obviously the one everyone thinks of is hyperactivity. And that's very often you think of like a young boy running around, rah. That's always kind of been in the media. We've been very aware. The symptoms, because there's hyperactive ADHD, there's also inattentive ADHD, which there's a much higher percentage of women that get diagnosed with that. So it's the one that's often missed, and it's the one that we're becoming aware of. And the symptoms of that, like the official DSM symptoms, are losing your phone keys and wallet, losing things all the time, forgetting important dates and not turning up to appointments, getting sidetracked. If you're meant to be doing something, getting sidetracked with something else. Like, it's all the shit that just makes you think you're a bit of a shit human. Mm. They are like the official symptoms. Everyone that I've ever met that's been diagnosed, especially later in life, was living with the sense that they were a bad adult. So if like you're living feeling like you're failing, you're behind on bills, behind on work, can't look at a spreadsheet, can't keep on top of finances, that could be a sign that there's neurodivergence or ADHD there.
And then I think that is sort of, I don't want to oversimplify it, but like, I've got a little bit of a phrase with Rox, whereas I will treat things with curiosity rather than judgment, because she will do things that will not make sense to me. And so if, you know, any listeners got a partner of ADHD, they will do some weird stuff sometimes. And it's just, they've been judged all their life by all the neurotypical people so this leads to a sense that they're doing things wrong. So just treating things with curiosity rather than judgment will change everything. I think it did for us anyway.
Like, why have you got all your clothes on the floor on a floor drobe?
Yeah, rather than what the fuck rather are you
than
doing?
You messy fucker, pick up the clothes. It's a lovely difference.
I think that's what I love so much about your platform is it's kind of normalizing the conversation from both perspectives. And I think that's really important. And I saw something you posted the other day that was just about lists. And I was just going through the comments about the list because you could just see in the comments that people were like, oh, wow, I really identify with that, or I don't do that. And seeing those two very different things about you needing to write a to-do list of everything and you writing a to-do list of like the things that you naturally would forget. And it was so interesting in the comments because I could even see people there being like, oh, shit, I do that. And I think that's such an amazing thing because it's making people really understand the nuances of ADHD and what might just be something that's neurotypical that we all do.
Yeah, I think the list is so funny because you can sort of hear the symptoms, but it's sometimes the real life funny example that allows people to really connect with it. So it doesn't feel like this clinical list. It's like a human being doing what you do. And the to-do list thing was funny because it speaks to something really deep, which is a good and bad thing for ADHD. So ADHD brains don't have boundaries. So when you're writing a to-do list, I don't know to put only the important work. I will put write a to-do list, wake up, shower, eat breakfast, go to the gym. Like everything goes on. Then you've written 100 things. I'm like, fucking hell, never going to get through that.
And you're not allowed to urinate all day unless it's written
down. Unless it's written down, you can't
breathe.
Like the breathing is the only thing I don't write on. Like there's no boundaries to know what goes on. Same if I'm going to clean the bedroom. I do not know where to start because there's no rules. There's no boundaries. So I'm like in the corner with a toothbrush scrubbing something, missing just the very simple rules. However, no boundaries in life either. So it's like, I think I'm going to go and become a rock artist at 37. Don't see the boundaries. Yeah. Go and do it, or like do the social media or write a book. So where in the kind of basic day-to-day life you might struggle with not understanding the rules of the game, you also don't understand the limitations of life. So it makes you wildly optimistic, which actually can be a really good thing when it comes to creating.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't have started any of it. Well, the thing is, I wouldn't have started any of this really, that like the ADHD, the social media, and Rox wouldn't have followed any of it through. So like that's where the both of us
power
combined.
Yeah, that's amazing.
That's why you need teamwork, isn't it? Like one person should have to do everything.
Yeah.
Like it's the beauty of like teams, and it's just, I'm very lucky to have.
It's interesting, isn't it, even from a creative viewpoint, because obviously, you know, Sam, who I work with, and he's vocalized a lot that, you know, he thinks he has undiagnosed ADHD.
I would say.
And, you know, and yes. I think the both of us together as a duo, because he's like so like creative and then like hyper focus and so like all over the place and that. And I'm like the person that comes in and I'm like the music producer, if anything, like I'm like, right, let's take that way, do this. We need to be here, this. And like, I think as like a duo, it works really like nicely together.
So true. It's actually very similar. It's a very similar dynamic.
So it's interesting to see. But yeah, I think before we go to the big questions, the book you've got coming out, let's talk about it. I know you've just touched on it briefly.
Yeah, so it's called Small Talk, and it's the 10 ADHD lies and how to stop believing them. And those lies are the I'm lazy, I'm useless, I'm a failure, it's too late to make something in life, I quit everything I start, everybody hates me, ADHD isn't real. Like all of the stuff that lies underneath the symptoms.
And to your point, similar to our first book, we both write the book. So and it sort of take turns in Rox's perspective, my perspective. So
yeah, so I think it's really good because it helps partners, parents, friends of ADHD people as well. So just taking the classic, which is I'm lazy, and I kind of work through this core belief, a bit like the time machine.
We are going to fall out. You make it sound like a horny cat.
Sorry. Bit like the time machine, of which I'll let you do the noise.
Thank you.
Going back, where did the belief start that I'm just lazy? And it starts in childhood. it really cements through teenage years. And in adulthood, I'm just living under that. Yeah. 100%. I'm lazy. I'm a piece of shit. And how I kind of work through realizing that I'm not lazy, because just like Sam, I can hyperfocus for 8 hours and like write a book or write a song, but I can't work every day, organize, can't do my emails, can't keep a calendar. I just work really hard in my own way.
Mm. Sure.
And then for you, it's like, actually, it would make sense that you think an ADHD person is lazy, because for a neurotypical person, if they were doing this, they would be lazy. Clothes all over the floor.
Or disrespectful.
Or disrespectful. Yeah. And you kind of work through how you reframed thinking in that way, which I think is so helpful, because there's no shame of looking at someone who's messy all over the place thinking they're lazy. I think that's normal. But it's trying to raise awareness for that.
Well, the reality is, like, the relationship wouldn't work if it was just Rox's self-acceptance that was there. So like, for these people that have got like loved ones, they need to be on board as well. Otherwise it's just one person sort of doing the work and doing the understanding, and the other one just shaming them. And we touch on it in the book, but it's, I'm going to say it wrong now probably, but like, by the time an ADHD person is 9 years old, they've received 10,000 more pieces of negative feedback than those of a neurotypical person.
So it's 10 years old and 20,000.
Right, there you go then.
There you go.
Even more.
There you go.
Like double.
1 year double.
Double. 1 year.
Which in terms of actual loads, like reinforcement of like, when you talk about like the core values and beliefs, it's going to take a huge like impact on what you think of yourself.
Well, that's where we, or who knows, but that's where we think it comes from. Mm. Like, when you've got the whole world telling you you're doing stuff wrong, or that you're lazy, or that you're clumsy, or whatever, all those like
it's always negative, it's always shame, and it's always try hard enough, you'd have potential if, oh, can't you just stop? It's the eye rolls. Mm. And like, kids just absorb that in their foundational years, 0 to 7, and then you walk around thinking that you're broken and awful, and then turn to drink and drugs and then make it even worse. So really,
I have something else I want to discuss before the big questions. I'm sorry.
Wait, what are the big questions? Is that the time?
Well, actually, we're going to have to even change the big questions. Yeah, like, what is the meaning of time? step into my time machine. No. I actually, because we did a relationships episode with an amazing couple called Ricky and Alicia, and they went sober on the same day. So they went on their journey together. Wow. And actually, I thought, obviously, whilst we focus a little bit on ADHD, I'd love to just quickly ask about, as a sober person who's maybe supporting someone going on a journey of sobriety, kind of how you felt like you could support each other, or some of the takeaways you felt, Rich, during that
so
period.
I think the most important thing for me watching you make those decisions was that it was you, that I wasn't trying to control it or force it, because obviously if you make a decision out of being controlled by someone else, it won't stick and it's not healthy. So it's really just, there's a gorgeous recovery saying, which is like, carry the message, not the mess. And that's not being rude. That's not calling you a mess at the time,
okay,
but maybe a tiny bit. So it's like, I get to say, here's how it helped me. Here's how I got out of debt. Here's how I got out of these patterns. You do that with that what you will. So it's just sharing your story and allowing that enough, the light of that to be enough, like that conversation where I just shared about why I identified as an alcoholic and you identified. I wasn't saying you should do this, you should go to AA, you should go to therapy. That's, nobody likes to be told what to do. I had plenty of people telling me, maybe you should cut back on a Coke. Oh, fuck off. Didn't ever listen, but it was the one bloke that just sat down and shared his story with me.
Yeah.
That made a difference. So it's just share your story, just be there. And what do you think? Like, obviously dating someone that, I mean, I was still a baby. I was only a year and a half, but.
Like, I, thinking back, and I don't even know whether this would be the right thing to say, but it's true for me. I don't think I could have done it alone. That seems almost impossible. So Rox being sober, having somebody to talk about a therapy session with, talk about a meeting, they would understand, like they get it, like they speak the same language. I don't think I could ever be with somebody that isn't sober now. Like, I know that that's, I just don't think I could.
I fully feel the same. And I never thought that was even a possibility until you're like, wow. And it's not that the other person may be doing anything wrong, but for your own journey and your own acceptance, like having that mutual understanding, I think is so important.
Which you know, hats off and hearts out to all the people that have had to just do it alone. Well, you done it alone before, like for the first year and a half.
I did.
I don't know how.
Meetings. I relied on meetings really, really hard because it's the first year. Well, your rock bottom night and then the shame that comes after that is pretty intense.
It's so amazing though, like your whole, both of your journeys separately coming together. Your episode with us was so beautiful. Everything you've shared with us has been stunning. And then coming together and creating a platform which is not even sobriety based, but you're both sober, but it's also helping people that are neurodivergent, but also in a way does lead into alcohol and drugs and sobriety. Like, it's fucking amazing.
Thank you. Yeah. It's the core of everything we do, like always. We always say, like, if we were still drinking, there'd be no time. You know, like, you get so much more time back when you go sober. You fill it with podcasts and social media channels. Yeah. It's the best thing. And if we'd done a sober channel, it would have been a really wanky one because I would have got it so wrong because I was one of those.
This is great. Leave it to you guys.
It's the perfect thing. And just so grateful to, like, be part of it and just well done for, like, the most amazing, like, tone and space for people to chat.
You.
Love
I think our thing, I wonder if you guys feel the same, is like we said that we will continue doing this as long as it's helping people. Because it's not about us. And I think that's the thing I'm having to learn and accept. And I think we're probably quite similar. I never wanted to be in front of a fucking camera. I never wanted to be like hosting something. It's not in my DNA. But the minute we put out your episode and we just got flooded with messages of support and love and seeing the, you know, hundreds we get a week, it's like, this is worthwhile. So even I'm like pushing myself into places that I'm like, I'm really uncomfortable with this, but like, it's helping people.
100%. I think also one of the gifts of sobriety is to, you get so much joy from helping people. The joy used to come from personal success or being wrecked. It now comes from helping people. Yeah. You're like, oh my God, they were all right. All those, like, older, wise people. Yeah.
But not in a wanky way. That's what I have to say. It's really not in a wanky way.
No, but it honestly makes my day. Like, when we get a message, like, through that saying it's having a positive impact, it genuinely makes my day. And it's not to go and put it all over Instagram and be like, fucking look at what we're doing. It's just like, it just feels like we're doing something good.
Yeah, we're really keen not to share, like, obviously we'd never share anyone's personal stories, but there's a lot of other platforms that are just screenshotting everything and sharing all the time. Yeah. And it's like, it's such a personal sobriety and finding yourself in any shape or form, such a personal thing.
It's humility though, isn't it? Like, it's very humble. You're just doing your thing. You've got this wicked branding. It's very open about men in therapy.
Very bright.
That's it.
It's very bright
pink. I love it.
It's very, very,
it's very masculine.
Yeah.
Go on, you want to do it?
I think it's time.
Okay.
I don't know what we're doing for the big one.
I think we're just going to go for the big three, and I think it needs to be you've done yours.
Oh, fine.
Yeah, you're off the hook.
Rich is like,
so Rich is in
the hot seat. Are they like one-word answers? What?
You just remember what they are. So, three questions we ask at the end of every episode. So, firstly, for anyone thinking of going on a journey of sobriety, what's the best single piece of advice you could give them?
One day at a time. So, it feels, if you think that you're making a decision to never drink again, it will feel far too overwhelming. Just don't drink today. See how you feel tomorrow.
Great advice. Very great advice. Question two, what's the single best thing that sobriety has brought you?
Wow. One single.
It's hard.
That's well hard. I'm gonna come away from emotion, actually. I'm gonna go time. So I never used to have any time because it would be in the pub. So, and that time, you'll want to use it to just achieve stuff that you have always wanted to do. And you never seem to have time when you were drinking. Well, I didn't anyway.
Feel that. And number three, we would like you to write a letter to Drunk Rich from Sober Rich. If you could start with Dear Rich.
Wait, Drunk Rich and Sober Rich?
No, so what would Sober Rich say to Drunk Rich?
Like, he knows that he'd lose the letter or not open it. Do you know what I mean? No, right, I'll be serious.
Like 18-year-old Rich.
Yeah, so... Do you know what? Naturally, I want to say, like, you know, be a bit, like, wanky and be like, it's not your fault, it's okay, you're doing your best. But I wouldn't write it. What I would write is...
Hold on, you've got to do the Dear Rich. We've got to hear the letter.
I'm really direct though. I'm terrible at this.
Just do it.
So, dear Rich, I think you've got a problem with alcohol. I would, because I'd want to know.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah.
You use it because of the abuse. You're using it to suppress your emotions. Go and seek help. Trust me. Love, sober Rich.
Yes.
Nice. Because I wouldn't want the validation at that point. I just want to know something's wrong. Like, yeah. I just want to know so I can go and do something.
I mean, it's concise. I wrote like a 5-page essay, obviously.
I'm sure you did, but that's just concise.
You got a problem. Go get some help.
Do you know what's fascinating, though, is because my letter was so similar to yours. Okay. When I listened back, I was like, hang on, I was just like me gushing at myself.
And yeah.
Was like, it like, you're doing your best, it's not your fault? Was it that sort
It was
of
basically like... Everyone that's died in your life would have been proud of you and loved you.
It was blah, heavy. Blah, blah.
Yeah, that was mine. Okay. But like, interestingly, more guests we've had on recently have been more practical with it and being really like, yeah, sort this out or do this or do that. Yeah.
A bit of guidance.
Yeah,
guidance. A little bit of a...
Yeah, like a firm, you can do it.
Well, it's quite a tough one to verbalise, because like whilst you wanna give... like the sort of drinking version of yourself, some sort of like hope and inspiration, I also wouldn't change anything. Mm. Like, I'm also just like, I'm a firm believer that my whole journey, I mean, maybe I wish I hadn't fucking caned it quite as hard.
I was going to say, give me an extra 5 years back and I'll be just, happy.
Like, maybe not go quite as hard for quite as long. But like, you know, I guess it's like the journey that leads and you go on has to get to a certain point. But I'm regretful of people that perhaps I hurt.
Yeah,
I think that's the biggest thing that like you wish you could not have done.
100%.
But aside from that, but yeah, that was great. That was really concise.
I just think it had to be, because if it was all like, you know, gushy, I know that 18-year-old drunk me would have thought, what a fucking wanky letter, and I'd have burnt it. Like, I wouldn't have give a shit. Like, I just, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's just, so you've written it as a way that would get through to 18-year-old.
I love that.
Yeah, nice.
I like that. Smart.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I wrote mine to like 9-year old. That was a Now I listen back, I think I wrote mine to 9-year old me.
There you go.
Yeah. Not 21-year old me.
Mine was definitely.
Because 21 year old me, I would have been like, I'm fine.
Fuck you.
Yeah, I feel
No, it's good. But like, guys, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
It's been
so
an amazing chat. And yeah, I think really invaluable stuff to the listeners. And yeah.
Yeah, we love what you guys are doing, and it means a lot that you've taken time out of your day.
No problem. Enjoyed it. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much. Absolutely love it. Cheers, guys.
ADHD love, baby.
Wow. What an episode.
Man, that was up there.
It was.
I don't want to big ourselves up too much, but I'm going to say that season 3 has fucking delivered.
Mate, it has.
And we're leaving a lot for season 4 to live up
to. I know. And to be honest, we've still got the rest of season 3 to get through.
Yeah, we do. And a lot of work to do.
And a lot of work to do, which is slightly terrifying. And also, my like back end of the year is heavily, it's looking, I mean, I've done quite well actually, that I haven't really done that many trips in the last 6 months.
No, you haven't.
And... As a consequence, what's happening is...
it all getting shoehorned.
As we're getting shoehorned. But I think from back in the summer, I'm going to be in LA for a substantial amount of time.
That's fine. I'm back in Oz in November, so we'll make it work.
We'll make it work. But actually, what we're going to do is there is... What's the saying? There's no... it's not disaster, only opportunity.
There you go. And yeah, but I think with that, like, you know, obviously the guest convos are amazing, but what being in Oz made me realise as well is like there's a hell of a lot of opportunity internationally to start exploring these things as well. So like there's a lot of op that we can do. And also like, you know, we've committed so far to be lucky enough to be in person with every single guest we've ever had.
Yeah.
Now there's a hell of a lot of podcasts that don't do that.
Yeah.
So, you know, if we need to do stuff remotely, we shall. But
exactly. So I'm looking forward to it. But yeah, amazing episode. And I feel super informative as well, you know, from, you know, the sort of research and viewpoint that both Rich and Rox from. So
it was amazing. And fair play to Rich for being so open and honest and candid, I guess, about his story. And I guess for Rox for understanding. And also, you know, for those guys meeting at a time when, you know, he wasn't sober, she was relatively early on, right? And I almost get this feeling that she was all in my head when she was describing it, like this almost meek kind of mouse that's kind of peering around the corner and like trying to, you know, likes this guy. And then he's obviously dealing with his own stuff and kind of going on this beautiful journey together. And it brought up a couple of big points for me. And I think the big one that I wanted to talk about was like safety.
Yeah.
In relationship and safety in finding someone and safety in people understanding and supporting the journey, because both of them clearly at their own time had their own shit going on. And it's very easy in sobriety, I think, for us all to be like, I'm just going to deal with this on my own because it's my journey.
Yeah.
And I think you can meet people where it's not codependent, it's not unhealthy, and it can be a support system and a support network, and you can actually grow together and heal together and be together. And yeah. That will come with its shit. That will come with its unboxing. You know, I think we spoke on the episode about like an issue I have, which I think Rory said the same about, like, you know, always thinking someone's mad at you or always thinking that you've done something wrong, because that's how we've been brought up in certain trauma loops, right? But ultimately, like, yeah, that idea that in sobriety together you can feel safe and in love.
Yeah, it's amazing. And mate, I really, really enjoyed the episode. I took a lot from it myself. So I think it's going to be one of our best episodes yet.
I think so.
And I hope you agree.
How do you feel? Because obviously, like, we've been in separate scenarios in life about, like, you know, I've found new relationship in sobriety. You've solidified relationship in sobriety. Mm-hmm. How was it for you listening to, like, those guys who I guess have been on that journey together? Did you, because I really resonated with it because I've been in the scenario. How did you resonate with that?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, I suppose it's a little bit of a different scenario. I think what's really interesting is that we talk about it a lot, about the whole sliding the mirror analogy. And I think that's what Rory did with Rich.
Yeah.
I think it's almost like he was looking and hearing her story and was like, oh shit.
Yeah.
And I think everyone has that kind of moment where they feel it. And, you know, I think as far as my like relationship has gone, I mean, everyone is around me is infinitely better off with me being sober. Yeah. And, you know, Sarah's way happier. And then, you know, we've talked about it a couple of times as well, where we're almost like navigating the situations now where she wants to go out and have a couple of drinks. And, you know, I think I talked about it in New Year's when I struggled and found it a little bit difficult because I wanted to leave. And, but, you know, we're working it out. I'm very vocal about those situations and how I feel. And she's been nothing but supportive. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think she'd rather, you know, a couple of times if we're going out together, come back a bit earlier or, you know, leave the night earlier for the sake of having, you know, everything now than me being completely off my box and not knowing where I am and like, you know, spearheading the night. Because on those nights out previously, I would have just like, I would have, rallied everyone up, rolled everyone up and like taken everyone to the next place.
And isn't it interesting? Because you and I in those scenarios, I don't want to speak for you, but I think we're probably the same. I would have put my partner at the bottom of the list.
Yeah.
If they were like, I want to go home, I would have been like, nah, babe, it's fine. You go. Or like, I'll see you at home. And off I would have gone into the sunset with them or without them. Cause I was like Captain Sesh.
Yeah.
And then when the shoe's on the other foot, I have this immense guilt. I'm like, fuck, what the fuck did I put someone through for like 12, 15 years? Cause then when it then happened to me on the other side, when I was sober and my ex-partner wasn't, they weren't doing anything wrong. But I'd then go home and be like, oh, like, either this is quite lonely or like, I don't know where you are or you vanished or I can't get hold of you or like, where are you? And I was like, that for the most part probably was me in my mid-20s. And the guilt is like, you can only act on how you feel today. But for me now looking back, I'm like, holy shit. When the shoe's on the other foot, reflective.
Oh, mate, completely agree. Yeah. I mean, I look back and I have immense guilt of, you know, doing that. And there'd been times where I'd been out where Sarah would be like, I want to go home. I've got X to do in the morning. Or like, we've got to be up. And I'm like, no, don't worry about it. It's fine. Like, just literally brush it under the carpet and be like, don't worry, come with. Yeah. Or, and yeah, I feel terrible about that. Because like you say now, I'm like, oh shit. Like when someone wants to leave, it's a pretty like big thing. Like someone normally.
Well, yeah, because it's probably someone saying to you like, I'm uncomfortable in this. It's not necessarily like, oh, I just don't want to be here. It's like, I'm uncomfortable in the situation and I would like to leave.
Yeah.
And it's selfish of us to be like, no, you're fine.
Yeah. But it's just like, yeah, the sesh took priority so much. And yeah, I still feel guilt about it, but there's nothing I can do now. And now I realize and I'm like, oh shit, that's really like, it was really bad of me. But, you know, all part of the learning process, my liege.
It is. But to come back to the episode, I think, you know, it's difficult I never want to talk too much on the ADHD thing because, you know, there's still a lot more research I need to do and learn about it. But mm-hmm. I hope for a lot of our listeners that are listening or have been, you know, diagnosed with ADHD or think they might have ADHD or have had addictive tendencies that they're then starting to see patterns that might, you know, maybe lead towards a diagnosis, or you've got a partner that does, all the fucking variables. I really hope that you took something from that episode because, you know, I think in life now, too many people are like, well, I've got ADHD. And it's just like this almost term that's just like used if someone can't concentrate. But I think when you think about addiction or negative cycles of alcohol and drugs and people that do have ADHD, like you can see the rate. Was it 5 times more likely to get into dependency? I mean, that's intense. So more needs to be spoken about openly in that sphere.
100%. And hopefully this episode does some good in that space.
Yeah, 100%. So I loved it. And yeah, like we said at the start of the ep, like Rory's going to be on our live show, which is just so exciting. I think it's going to be amazing.
Yeah, I'm very, very excited for it. And it's now less than 3 weeks.
3 weeks away.
2 weeks and 6 days away.
2 weeks and 6 days
oh,
away.
Oh my goodness. So yeah, but no, I'm really, really excited for it. And
well, we're into like full, by the time this episode comes out, I think we would have done 2 full rehearsals and we've got 2 more to go.
That's right.
And we've worked out a really cool concept with David actually, which I'm really excited for you guys to, because I think the big thing with the live show is like, we're going to have these amazing talks and talk about shared experiences and lived experiences and what everyone's going through. The concept that we've come up with David's great, because I think it's going to really give tools to people that are sober curious and go away with something from that episode,
yeah.
from that experience. That's like, yeah, just to grab onto, really.
Definitely. No, I'm excited.
And also
it.
It's mental that like less than a year, 10 months after we started this podcast, we're going to be doing a talk to like 400 people.
That's
it still
crazy.
Blows my mind. When I was out in Oz, my mate was like, are you aware of how stupid that is? Like, in the sphere of like how long it takes people to do things. And I was like, kind of no, because I know what you and I like. And I've kind of been like blinkers on and just gone with it. But actually, I was listening to one of my favorite podcasts on the way home, and they've been going 12, 13 years now. And I only started doing live shows like 4 or 5 years ago.
Mate,
so it made me realize, like, and also the amount of people that are messaging us, like, come to Manchester, come to Ireland, come to Bristol. We can't yet because we don't know the numbers there and we can't replicate what we've done in London. But, you know, we will start to, I think, be more proactive in getting people together in those markets if we can.
I think so. You know, when the time allows us and the data allows us to do so, we will do it. You know, we're not afraid of doing a tour.
We're not. And I think, like, you know, we've got big plans for this, and we've got big plans. I think you and I both got to a thought process, I think, where when we got to 10,000 Instagram followers, that felt like we really had built the community to a space where we could kind of exercise some other plans and some other ambitions and like bring a bigger community together. So we're super close to that now. So I think once that's there, we'll be revealing a bunch more about what our plans are. But as for the minute, you know, TikTok's flying.
Yep.
YouTube's, everything's there. So like, hopefully you guys feel like we're not just, you know, on your Spotify, Apple or Instagram now, like you can go and find us in everywhere. And if you've got anyone that might benefit from listening to us or benefit from what we're talking about, like you can find us on any platform pretty much now, which is mad.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think what we've done and what we've achieved in the short kind of space of time is, you know, it's just a testament to the fact that there is a community there that was wanting for maybe a space like this to kind of engage. And yeah, I feel grateful that we have so many people that tune in each week and the amount of people that message us, because like it really does, it's the accountability for us. We talk about it a lot, but it also, you know, encourage us to keep going when we get those messages from people saying, you know, finding it really helpful and useful, because like, that's why we do it. And it's cost us a shitload of money.
So much money.
you know, and it's worth it. It is worth it for the fact that we are building this community and, you know, we're trying to take it live and make it informative for people. And, you know, we might fuck up on the way. Like, you know, I'm terrified of the live show, actually. It was me and you going up in front of 400 people talking about it. We're not like, it's not what we're primed to do.
No, and I am definitely at risk of saying something wildly inappropriate. Like, I get away with it on this audio form. Connor sometimes has to edit some of my jokes. Who knows? But that's the thing as well. Like, we're rehearsing the show, but we're rehearsing the structure. We're not rehearsing what we're actually saying on it. Like, it's relatively unscripted. For that reason, I think it's important that we're not coming up there just like with a rehearsed show. That's boring. Like, it's going to be pretty wild and off the cuff. So, but as ever, look, thanks to everyone for tuning in, supporting us, because it's crazy. We're somehow like 3/4 of the way through season 3.
Yep.
Which is mad.
Yeah.
So we're just hurtling through this at the rate of knots, and then it's summer, and then we'll be a year old.
We will be.
Happy birthday to us.
Yep. Happy birthday for June. So
weirdly, and then it will be my 2 years, which is pretty much when I came up with the idea with you
initially.
At Caroline's thing, which would have been mid-July 2022.
Yeah.
Bonkers.
Wow.
So, but guys, thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate it. Keep sharing, keep liking, keep doing all the shit that you do. I fucking hate the sales stuff. but yeah, just appreciate you all dearly.